This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Broken Bubble by Philip K. Dick, performed by Nick Podell. One. Luke trades big. Summer is here, and Luke is mighty ready to make a deal with you, mighty ready, at three big lots, all of them busting with cars, cars, cars. What do you think your old car's worth? Maybe it's worth more than you think on a brand new Plymouth or Chevrolet four-door sedan, or a Ford Custom Deluxe Ranch Wagon. Luke is trading big these days, buying big and selling big. Luke thinks big. Luke is big. Before Luke came, this wasn't much of a town. Now it's a really big car town. Now everybody drives a brand new DeSoto with power windows, power seat. Come see Luke. Luke was born in Oklahoma before he moved out here to great old sunny California. Luke moved out here in 1946 after we beat the Japs. Listen to that sound truck that's going up and down the streets. Listen to it go. It goes all the time. It pulls that big red signboard along, and all the time it's playing the Too Fat Polka and saying, "Regardless of the make or condition of your old car." Hear that? It don't matter what kind of old heap you got. Luke will give you $200 for it if you can drag, walk, tow, push it into the lot. Luke wears a straw hat. He wears a double-breasted gray suit, and he wears crepe-soled shoes. In his coat pocket, he carries three fountain pens and two ballpoint pens. Inside his coat is an official blue book. Luke takes it out and tells you what your heap is worth. Look at that hot California sun pouring over Luke. Look at his big face sweat. Look at him grin. When Luke grins, he slips $20 into your pocket. Luke gives away money. This is Automobile Row. This is the street of cars, Van Ness Avenue, San Francisco. Windows on all sides, all along and up and down. Glass with words written in red and white poster paint. Banners are pasted up high and flags flutter, and over some lots are wads of colored aluminum strung on wire. And there are balloons, and in the evening, lights. At night, the chains go up. The cars are locked, but lights come on. Fine spotlights, fine big beams of color frying the bugs. And Luke has his clowns, his painted lady and gent clowns. They stand on top of the building and wave their arms. Luke has his microphones, and the salesmen call to people. Free quart of oil, free dish, free candy and cap gun for the kids. The steel guitar sings, and how Luke likes that. It sings like home. Bob Posen, holding his initialed briefcase, wondered if he had been recognized as a salesman, which, in fact, he was. He put out his hand, saying, "I'm Bob Posen, from radio station KOIF, station manager." He was now at Looney Luke's used car lot, trying to sell airtime.
"Yep," Sharpstein said, picking his teeth with a silver toothpick.
He wore gray slacks and a lemon-yellow shirt. Like all the West Coast used car dealers, his skin was baked red and dry, flaky around his nose.
"We're wondering when we'd hear from you."
They meandered among the cars.
"Nice-looking cars you have here," Posen said.
"All clean," Sharpstein said. "Every one a clean car."
"Are you Luke?"
"Yeah, I'm Luke."
"You thinking of doing anything over the air?"
That was the big question. Rubbing his cheekbone, Sharpstein said,
"What sort of coverage your station got?"
He gave an estimate, twice the actual size. In these times, he was willing to say anything. Television was getting the accounts, and nothing was left now but Regal Pale Beer and L&M filter cigarettes. The independent AM stations were in a bad fix.
"We've been having a few spots on TV," Sharpstein said. "Works out pretty good, but they sure cost."
"And why pay for coverage of the whole Northern California area when your customers are right here in San Francisco?"
He had a talking point there. Station KOIF
with its 1,000 watts of operating power, reached as many people in San Francisco as did the network AM and TV stations, and at a fraction of the cost. They strolled to the car lot office. At the desk, Posen scratched figures on a pad of paper.
"Sounds good to me," Sharpstein said, his arms behind his head, his foot up on the desk. "Now tell me something. I have to admit I never got around to hearing your station. You got some kind of schedule I can see?"
KOIF went on the air at 5:45 a.m. with news and weather and Sons of the Pioneers records.
"Yep," Sharpstein said.
Then 5 hours of popular music, then noon news, then 2 hours of popular music from records and transcriptions, then Club 17, the kids' rock and roll show until 5, then an hour of Spanish language light opera and talk and accordion music, then dinner music from 6 until 8, then,
in other words, Sharpstein said, the usual stuff.
Balanced programming.
Music, news, sports, and religious. Plus spot plugs. That was what kept the station alive.
"What about this?" Sharpstein said. "How about a plug every half hour between 8 a.m. and 11 p.m.? 31-minute spots a day, 7 days a week."
Posen's mouth fell open. "Jesus Christ."
"I'm serious," Sharpstein said.
Sweat fell from Posen's arms into his nylon shirt.
Let's see what that would run.
He wrote figures. What a bundle. Sweat stung his eyes. Sharpstein examined the figures.
Looks okay. It'll be tentative, of course. We'll try it a month and see what kind of response there is. We haven't been satisfied with the Examiner ads.
And nobody reads that,
Posen said hoarsely. Wait, he thought, until Ted Haynes, the owner of KOIF, was informed.
I'll do your material myself. I'll handle the material personally.
You mean write it?
Yes, he said.
Anything. Everything. Sharpstein said,
we'll supply the material. It comes from Kansas City, from the big boys. We're part of a chain. You just put it on the air.
Radio station KOIF was located on narrow, steep Geary Street in downtown San Francisco, on the top floor of the McLaughlin Building. The McLaughlin Building was a drafty, antiquated wooden office building with a couch in the lobby. There was an elevator, an iron cage, but the station employees usually went up by the stairs. The door from the stairs opened onto a hallway. To the left was the front office of KOIF, with one desk, a mimeograph machine, typewriter, telephone, and 2 wooden chairs. To the right was the glass window of the control room. The wide board floor was unpainted. The ceilings, high above, were yellowed plaster, cobwebbed. Several offices were used as storerooms. Toward the back, away from the traffic noises, were the studios. The smaller of the two was the recording studio, and the other, with more adequate soundproof doors and walls, was for broadcasting. In the broadcast studio was a grand piano. A corridor divided the station into 2 sections. The corridor cut off from the main offices a large room in which was an oak table, on which were piles of folded and unfolded mailouts, envelopes, cartons like the workroom of a campaign headquarters. And next to that, the room in which the transmitter controls were located, the board itself, a swinging mic, 2 Presto turntables, upright record cabinets, a supply cabinet on the door of which was tacked a photograph of Eartha Kitt, and of course, there was a bathroom and a carpeted lounge for visitors, and a closet in which to hang coats or hats and to store brooms. A door at the back of the studio corridor opened onto the roof. A catwalk led past chimneys and skylights to a flight of shaky wooden stairs that connected with the fire escape. The roof door was unlocked. Occasionally, station employees stepped out onto the catwalk for a smoke. The time was 1:30 in the afternoon, and KOIF was transmitting songs by the Crew Cuts. Bob Posen had brought in the signed contract with Looney Luke Automotive Sales and had gone out again. At her desk in the front office, Patricia Gray typed bills from the accounts receivable file. In the control room, Frank Hubble, one of the station announcers, leaned back in his chair and talked on the telephone.
The music of the crew cuts from the PM speaker boxed in the upper corner of the wall filled the office. The stairs door opened, and another announcer entered. A tall, thin, rather worried-looking man wearing a loose-fitting coat. Under his arm was a load of records. "Hi," he said. Patricia stopped typing and said, "Have you been listening to the station?"
"No."
Preoccupied, Jim Briskin searched for a place to put down his records.
"Some Looney Luke material arrived. Hubble and Flannery have been giving it off and on. Some of it is recorded and some isn't."
A slow smile spread across his face. He had a long, horse-like face and the overgrown jaw that many announcers seem to have. His eyes were pale, mild. His hair was brownish-gray and beginning to recede.
"What's that?"
"The used car lot up on Van Ness."
His mind was on the afternoon programming. He was planning out Club 17, his program, his 3 hours of tunes and talk for the kids.
"How is it?" he said.
"It's just awful."
She put a page of material before him. Balancing his records against his hip, he read the typed pages.
"Will you call Haynes and read this stuff to him? Bob called him and slurred over. He just talked about the income."
"Be quiet," he said, reading.
1A. The car you buy today from Looney Luke will be a clean car, and it will stay clean. Looney Luke guarantees it. 2A. Echo. Clean, clean, clean. 1A. A clean car. Clean upholstering. A clean deal from Looney Luke, the volume car dealer who outsells in big volume sales all other car dealers in the Bay Area. 2A. Echo. Sells, sells, sells. Instructions on the script called for the announcer to record the echo parts in advance. The counterpoint was his own voice, knocking against itself.
"So?" he said.
It seemed routine to him, the usual used car pitch. Pat said,
"But that's yours, for the dinner music stretch. Between the Romeo and Juliet overture," she looked at the evening programming, "and Till Eulenspiegel."
Picking up the phone, Jim dialed Ted Haynes' home number. Presently, Haynes' measured voice was heard saying,
"Who is calling?"
"This is Jim Briskin," he said.
"On your phone or the station phone?"
"Tell him about the laugh," Pat said.
"What?" he said, putting his hand over the mouthpiece of the phone, and then he remembered the laugh. The laugh was Looney Luke's trademark. The sound truck carried it about town, and the loudspeakers in the illuminated towers of the car lot blasted it at the cars and pedestrians. It was a crazed laugh, a funhouse laugh. It went around and around, rising and falling, getting down into the belly in a slowed-down manner and then shooting up into the sinuses, all at once a sharp laugh, very shrill, a giggle. The laugh bubbled and simpered. Something was wrong with it, something terrible and basic. The laugh became hysterical. Now it could not contain itself. It burst frothily, fragmenting itself. Collapsing, the laugh sank down. Winded, gasping, exhausted by the ordeal, and then, dragging in deep breaths, it started over. On and on it went, 15 hours without let-up, rolling out above the shiny Fords and Plymouths, over the Negro in knee boots who washed the cars, over the salesmen in their pastel suits, over the flat lots, the office buildings, the downtown business district of San Francisco, and ultimately over the residential sections. Over the apartment houses with their single walls joining them in rows, over the new concrete houses near the beach, over all the houses and all the stores, all the people in the town. "Mr. Haynes," he said, "I have some Looney Luke material here for the dinner music program. This stuff isn't going to go over, not with the kind of audience I have. The old ladies out by the park don't buy used cars, and they turn this stuff off as fast as they can get to the radio and..."
"I see your point," Haynes said. "But it's my understanding that Posen agreed to air Sharpstein's material straight across the board each half hour. And anyhow, Jim, this is the nature of an experiment."
"Okay," he said. "But when we're through, we won't have any old ladies or any other sponsors. And by that time, Luke will have dumped his 90 carloads of 55 Hudsons or whatever it is he's pushing, and then what? You suppose he's going to keep this stuff up after he breaks the back of the other lots? This is just to knock them off.
You have a point, Haynes said.
Darn right I have.
I suppose Posen bid on this.
Afraid so, Haynes said.
Well, we've signed the contract. Let's go ahead and finish out our commitment to Sharpstein, and then in the future we'll be more wary of this sort of thing.
But, Jim said, you mean you want me to go ahead and give this on the dinner music? Listen to this.
He reached for the script. Pat handed it to him.
I know how it reads, Haynes said. I've caught it on the other independence. But I feel, considering the signed contract, we're really obliged to go ahead with it. It would be bad business to back out.
Jim said, Mr. Haynes, this will kill us.
It would kill sponsorship of the classical music anyhow. The little restaurants who supported classical music would back off, would vanish.
Let's give it a try and see, Haynes said, with the tone of judgment. Okay, boy. Maybe it'll work out to the good. After all, this is currently our heaviest advertising account. You must take the long-term view. Now, perhaps a few of those little fancy restaurants will act huffy for a while, but they'll be back. Right, boy?
They argued a little longer, but in the end, Jim gave up and said goodbye.
Thanks for calling me, Haynes said. I'm glad you feel you want to discuss this sort of problem with me out in the open where we can talk about it.
Putting the phone down, Jim said, Luke's cars are clean cars.
It's on then, Patricia said.
He took the script into the recording studio and began putting the 2A echo part onto tape. Then he switched on the other Ampex and taped 1A also and combined both so that at program time he had only to start the transport going. When he had finished, he rewound the tape and played it back. From the speakers, his own professional announcer's voice said, "The car you buy today from Looney Luke." While it played, he read over his mail. The first cards were requests from kids for current pop tunes, which he clipped to his continuity for the afternoon. Then a complaint from a businessman, a practical, outgoing individual, protesting that too much chamber music was being played on the dinner music program. Then a sweet note from a very gentle little old lady named Edith Holcomb, who lived out in Stonestown, saying how much she enjoyed the lovely music and how glad she was that the station was keeping it alive. Blood for his veins, he thought, putting her letter where he could refer to it. Something to show the advertisers. On went the struggle. 5 years of work, keeping up the pretense that this was his interest in life. He was devoting himself to this, to his music and programs, his cause. From the doorway, Pat said,
You going to play the Fantastic Symphony tonight?
I thought so.
She entered the room and seated herself across from him. In the comfortable armchair. Light flashed, a spark of yellow, as she lit a cigarette with her lighter. A present from him, given 3 years ago. Her legs rustled as she crossed them, smoothed her skirt. At one time, she had been his wife. A few trivialities still connected them. The Berlioz Symphony was one. An old favorite, and when he heard it, the whole background swam up. Smells, tastes, and the rustle, as now, of her skirt. She liked long, heavy, colorful skirts and wide belts and the kind of sleeveless blouse that reminded him of the chemises of the girls on the covers of historical novels. Her hair, too, was that flowing, uncombed mass, dark, soft, and always amiably in her way. Actually, she was not large. She weighed exactly 111 pounds. Her bones were small. Hollow, she had once informed him, like a flying squirrel's. There had been a number of such similes tying them together. When he remembered, he was vaguely embarrassed. Their tastes did not basically differ, and it was not on that account that the marriage had collapsed. The inside story he kept to himself, hoping that she had done the same, as office gossip it would have yielded indefinite harvest. They had wanted kids, right away, and plenty of them. And when no kids appeared, they had consulted specialists and discovered, lo, that he, of the two of them, was sterile.
But that had not been as bad as the next part, which involved Pat's desire to locate what was ingenuously called a donor. The bickering over that had split them up. In all seriousness, but with overtones of self-contempt and rage, he had suggested that she get herself a lover. An affair with emotional involvement had seemed more acceptable to him than the science fiction device of artificial insemination. Or he had suggested, why not simple adoption? But the donor idea intrigued her. His theory, and it had not gone over well with Pat, was that she yearned for parthenogenesis, and so they had gradually lost any real understanding of each other. Now glancing up at her, he saw this attractive woman. She was still not over 27 or 28, and made out, as easily as ever, the qualities that had excited him in the first place. She had a genuine feminineness about her, not merely a daintiness or a diminutiveness or even a gracefulness. Those were present. But in addition, he recognized in her a basically active spirit. Across from him, Pat said in a low voice, "Do you know what this Loony Luke business means? It means the end of your classical music. He'll want Oki music, steel guitars, Roy Acuff. You'll be squeezed out. The old ladies won't listen. The restaurants won't keep on with us. And you..."
"I know," he said.
"And you're not going to do anything?"
"I did what I could," he said. "I made my gesture." She arose and put out her cigarette.
"The phone," she said.
In a sweep, a flow of color, she passed him. The brightness of her blouse brushed by. Buttons, too, at the center. How odd, he thought. Once, with his love for her, he had been on the proper track, a good husband. Now, if the idea came to him, it was a sin, and the act itself was unthinkable. Time and intimacy, the incongruity of life. He watched her go, feeling lonely, feeling that perhaps he did not have the answers, even yet. The principle of expectation. In him, yet, was this model, this standard of judgment. They had been divorced for 2 years, and in that time, he had not seen anyone who could equal her. "I hang around her," he thought. "I still have to be somewhere nearby." Returning to his records and letters, he prepared notes for his dinner music program.